Britain and Europe, or perhaps Britain or Europe. Because those who are remotely aware of the events of the last few decades will be aware that Britain and Europe cannot exist independently if Britain is to be a part of Europe. What we hope to look at this afternoon is Britain and Europe in the light of Bible prophecy. We're not political. Politics obviously has its right and it has its wrongs. But we do not wish to comment upon whether the Labour government is doing a worse job or better job than the Conservatives and vice versa. The whole purpose of this address is to give us an insight into the time of the end, with a view to seeing where Britain and Europe will stand when the Lord Jesus Christ returns to this earth, which he, as the Bible testifies, surely will. What we have seen in the ratification and the bringing into force of this Treaty of Lisbon, or the Lisbon Treaty, is an aim, it has its origins in something far more than just the European Steel and Co. Community, which was established in 1940s. I can't remember which year. It goes back a long, long way. And in fact, the split between Britain and Europe goes back as far as 1533. In this year, the then reigning monarch of this country was Henry VIII. And in this year, he divorced his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. She was Spanish, as the name would suggest, and married the young woman, Anne Boleyn. Now, it's quite significant. Again, we're not here to discuss the rights and wrongs of what Henry did. But it's quite significant in the formation of the British realm because it had several outcomes. First and foremost, it drove a huge wedge between Britain and Roman Catholicism. The Pope, as Henry declared, was no longer the head of the Church of England. Henry became the head of the Church of England. This, as you might guess, would make the Pope most very upset. Secondly, it created a rift between Britain and the battle axe of Roman Catholicism, Spain. Catherine of Aragon being Spanish herself, the situation between Britain and Spain became very tetchy over the next few centuries. And lastly, another outcome was that Anne herself was not Catholic like her predecessor, but rather a Protestant reformer, and encouraged Henry to provide freedom for the reformers of Britain, and really paved the way for the establishment of Protestantism or anti-Catholicism in Britain. Henry's words when he issued a decree to declare himself head of the church instead of the Pope was, "This realm of England is an empire." They were words, while not echoed in word, they were practically re-echoed many times over the next few centuries. "This realm of England is an empire." In 1547, Henry died and left his throne to his sickly son Edward, who died at the age of 15. He was a Protestant, and he tried to make sure that Britain retained its Protestantism by electing a certain Lady Jane Grey to be his heir. But Roman Catholicism had other plans, because in 1553, Mary, who was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, marched on London with her Catholic supporters, successfully claiming the crown from Lady Jane Grey, and executing her shortly after. Lady Jane Grey was but the first of many, many executions under Mary, who tried her best to re-establish Roman Catholicism in Britain, and she inherited the epitaph Bloody Mary due to that. But still, what she didn't realise is that Britain had had quite enough of the Dark Ages. It was in no mood to return to those days when a man was not able to study the Bible. He was not even allowed to own a Bible in his own language. Britain had had enough of that and was looking for emancipation from such bondage. She was unpopular, and she failed to change the minds of the people. And more so, despite marrying Philip II of Spain, she died childless. And the throne passed in 1558 to her sister, or half-sister, Elizabeth I, who was the daughter of Anne Boleyn. She became one of the greatest monarchs Britain has ever known, and has been titled the Occidental Star of the British Empire, and she essentially founded the British Empire. Now, her greatness was a great problem to the papacy, because the greatness of the British fleet in her day was beginning to be a problem to the Roman Catholic ships, especially as they returned from South America with their pillage, gold and silver. So the Spanish Armada was dreamt up. In 1588, Spanish ships sailed from Europe to attack and once again bring Britain under Roman Catholic European control. But due to the providence of God in the weather and the effectiveness of the English Navy, the Spanish Armada was a complete failure, and very few ships returned to the continent. She also died without marrying and had no offspring. So the throne passed to the Stuarts, where we see a slight return to Roman Catholic, or should I say Catholic, beliefs under James I in 1603. However, James I was not of the ilk to return to Rome. And he decided that he wanted to keep Britain's independency, and he retained the headship of the church. He did respect the Reformation and actually approved the translating of the English Bible, as our speaker looked at last week. And even here, we in James I's reign, we see Roman Catholicism trying to undermine and destroy the British Protestant crown. We all have heard of Guy Fawkes. He was only one of the donkeys in that that attempt to destroy Parliament and James I. Thomas Catesby was actually the leader, but Guy Fawkes was the one tasked with lighting the fuse to the gunpowder barrels, and as we know, they were all found and eventually rounded up and executed. So was this Roman Catholicism's last attempt to try and grab the British throne? We know, of course, that it was not. In 1625, Charles I ascends the throne instead of his father, James. He was an avid Roman Catholic who believed that he could rule by divine right without Parliament. Or in other words, he would rule at the behest of the papacy. Parliament knew the implications of this and opposed him. And we all know of the English Civil War, which raged from 1642 to 1648. Charles I was beheaded in 1649, and Oliver Cromwell, the Puritan, became Lord Protector of England until 1659. In 1660, Charles II, what was known as the Restoration, the Great Restoration, and people were quite happy to see Charles II ascend the throne again, back to royalty as opposed to a sort of republic which people were not favourable to. Charles II ascends the throne instead of his father and tries to do the same thing. In his later years, he actually dissolved Parliament. But he probably decided not to push things too far. He saw what had happened to his father and didn't want the same to happen to him. He had no legitimate heirs, although with 17 mistresses, he had probably quite a few children, but none of those were legitimate heirs. And so the throne passes on in 1688 to James, who became James II. He's not so well known as some of the other monarchs, but the events in James II's life resulted in some events which really quite strongly characterised Britain right up until this day. He dissolved Parliament, so exactly like his father and grandfather, he believed he could rule by divine right and essentially pass all sovereignty back to the Pope. But this was a problem because Parliament had more power than it ever used to have, and they tried to get William III, or William as he was to become William III, William of Orange, to attack Britain, and as he was a Protestant, and overthrow James II's tyrannical rule, and Roman Catholic rule at that. He was successful, and despite James II's attempt to invade in Northern Ireland, he was defeated by William of Orange, and hence we have the Orange Marches today. But as I said, these are very significant years for Britain, because we may have heard of the Act of Settlement. It was instituted as a result of James II's trying to rule by divine right and reverting to Roman Catholicism. It was known as the Glorious Revolution, and in this act, the divine right of kings was abolished. Because James II, we might say, ruled by this secret unaccountable council, which consisted of four Roman Catholic priests and a Jesuit. This was altered so that Britain entered a phase of what is known as constitutional monarchy. This act of settlement explains, "It hath been found by experience that it is inconsistent with the safety and welfare of this Protestant kingdom to be governed by a popish prince or by any king or queen marrying a papist." By experience. What experience? The bloodshed that goes back as far as Britain's history almost, whereby people were persecuted and put to death for just trying to open up a Bible and understand it. And this act of settlement laid down these rules or laws which prevented Britain returning to Roman Catholicism at all. James II then was the last truly Roman Catholic monarch of Great Britain. But Roman Catholic Europe still hadn't given up. Napoleon, who is slightly different because while he was a Catholic himself, he was a scourge on the Pope. But being a Catholic, he'd been indoctrinated, no doubt, with this view of this united Europe under one spiritual head. And he himself dreamt more than anything of bringing Britain once again into the pale of Roman Catholicism. And it is this dream that was his downfall. He lost his navy in the various encounters with the Royal Navy, and it was his arduous efforts to establish the continental system, which was a block on British trade, that induced him to make his two cardinal errors and ultimately the loss of his power. Those two errors were to invade Portugal and Spain in 1807, where he was defeated, and Russia again in 1812, where he lost most of his troops due to the cold and quite a few of his troops to the Russian soldiers. So even the world's greatest military leader failed to so much as set a foot on British soil. Now Napoleon, as I said, he was slightly different from most great Europeans in that he became a scourge on Catholicism as much as anybody else. And in his work, he brought an end to this time period which we know as the First Reich, or the Holy Roman Empire, which was established in AD 800 in Charlemagne's days. Napoleon ended this period then. But in 1871, we enter a new period which is known as the Second Reich, where we have these Kaisers of Germany. Even during this time, these great Europeans dreamt of bringing an end to Britain's independent sovereignty. We take the words of Kaiser Wilhelm II, I think it's the second or the third, he said, "After the elimination of the British and the Jews, the result will be a United States of Europe." Now that rings so true of what we see today. The result will be a United States of Europe. This vision has never abated. It stalled somewhat at the creation of the Weimar Republic, but before long, another leader of Germany arose. And let's remember that the Germans were generally the people, or the Austrians, and they're very closely linked as people, who were the military heads of the empire. The Pope was always the spiritual head and sat at Rome. Vienna became sort of the military or physical force behind Europe, established by Charlemagne, and the Germans and the Austrians had been the friends of the Pope ever since. And this was set to continue, because before long, another leader of Germany arose, who looked set to make the grandest move ever to bring Britain back under Roman Catholic rule. He had on his side the advantage of modern technology, or modern compared to even 20 or 30 years previous at the turn of the century. This leader was to be the most famous and infamous of Germany's leaders. Adolf Hitler, through his NSDAP party, created what's known as the Third Reich. Short-lived, it was one of the most evil systems ever known. But like Napoleon, exactly like Napoleon, he made the great mistake of focusing his efforts on conquering Britain. It was to be his downfall as well. But that policy was not new, as we've seen. It's just another effort in the diary, if you like, of Roman Catholicism to try and bring Britain back to be an ally or to be a vassal state to Roman Catholic Europe. And any honest reader of World War II history will realize that Hitler and the Pope were hand in hand. Roman Catholicism, Catholicism means worldwide. So by the very definition, Roman Catholicism means Romanism worldwide. It's their ambition to occupy the whole world. But with the help of its allies, and doubtless, with the help of God's intervention in the weather patterns and other things, we've only got to look at the evacuation of Dunkirk for an example of that, when the channel was like a mill pond and there was this huge fog which was present to stop the Nazi bombers, the Luftwaffe, preventing those activities. Through various things like this, Britain was spared being invaded by the Nazis, and the only Nazi personnel ever to tread British soil were those shot down over the skies of southern England. Evidently then, right up until 1945, British politicians, and to a degree, the British people, were vaguely aware enough of the Bible, even if they didn't understand the truth, to know that Britain was better off without being subservient to Rome. It was better off as an independent state, not to be brought under Roman Catholic rule, and they were prepared to fight to the death for it. The emancipation brought by the possession of an English Bible was felt. Even though the real issues were beginning to be sort of blunted, they still felt and appreciated the freedom from the Dark Ages, Roman Catholicism and its tyrannical rule. And yet, on the 1st of December 2009, the Treaty of Lisbon was brought into force, thus levelling Britain with the rest of the European states. I don't believe it's quite this simple technically, but essentially what we have is Britain as a territory within Europe rather than this independent sovereign country. Henry VIII's words no longer stand. It really needs to be said. This realm of England is no longer an empire. The Bible reformers, the roundhead soldiers of Cromwell, the soldiers of William of Orange, the soldiers and seamen in the days of the Napoleonic Wars, the soldiers of the First and Second World Wars, essentially lost their lives in vain. Because here we are, Europeans. But it isn't quite that simple as we hope to look at things. How did things come to this? How did the European powers gain the ascendancy over the British throne without even firing a shot? And we have to ask the question, is it really as bad as what we are making out? We'll answer that question in a little bit, but as to how we get to this point, we need how politics developed to this state can be traced back to probably around the time of World War II. Because while World War II was raging, another spirit was working in the British people. For Roman Catholic Europe is not the only continent that hates the British power. Russia hates the British Lion and would love to sink it in the waves it has ruled for so long. The Communist Manifesto's main policy was to corrupt the West. Have a look at the Communist Manifesto and you will see this. Corrupt the West, cause its power to wane, get rid of religion, open the door to humanism, undermine the power of the governments, and give the people power and pleasure. And strangely enough, this suits the papacy. Even though it says get rid of religion, it suits the papacy. Oh yes, religion, but the religion of Roman Catholicism is not as we understand it. The religion of Roman Catholicism is to keep the people totally ignorant and in the dark, and which leaves the priests and the spiritual leaders to do and control just as they please. So this suits the Pope because essentially, without any sort of understanding and appreciation of principles, Roman Catholicism can do pretty much what it wants. Was the policy successful? It was sadly the most successful enemy to ever engage the British people since William the Conqueror, and without even firing a shot. The power of the television, the power of internet, the magazines, the press, and the provision of multi-million leisure corporations and all these pursuits has destroyed any spirit of truth and moral force in this country. Without even knowing it, Britain has been overthrown by this almost invisible enemy. And if you doubt that claim, then look around at the empty or converted churches and chapels. They are testimony to this fact. In the drink-obsessed and pleasure-loving stupor, Britain was in no fit shape to see the true tentacles of the European Union when it began to spread across the channel in its true colours. And we have to say, it is not as though the EU has made any effort to mask its true identity. And Winston Churchill is quoted as being one of the visionaries of a united Europe. Oh yes, he said in that celebrated conference in Zurich in 1946, we must build a kind of a United States of Europe. Well, yes, he did say this, but he also said in that same speech, Great Britain, the British Commonwealth of Nations, mighty America and many other nations must be friends and sponsors of the new Europe. So his vision was not to have Britain within Europe, but to have Britain standing by as a friend of a united Europe. And Jacques Delors, who was one of the founders of the EU back in the days of the EEC, also said this. Even that great European, he says, Winston Churchill envisaged European integration only for the countries of the European continent, not for Britain. I was planning to read some of the history of the EU, but we are aware of the developments, really, and if not, it's not difficult to research. The Treaty of Paris in 1951 created the European Coal and Steel Community. That was essentially the beginning. And it's interesting because it was a Franco-German agreement. It was between France and Germany. And of course, it has developed to the point where we actually have 27 members. And as we know and already mentioned, on the 1st of December 2009, we became Europeans under this Treaty of Lisbon. As I said, the EU has never hidden its identity and aims, which is interesting. It's sort of portrayed as an economic kind of superpower, but the real issues go much deeper than this, and the EU really doesn't try too hard to hide these for anyone who cares enough to actually look. The stained glass window at the Council of Europe in the Strasbourg Cathedral, where the Council of Europe is held in the Strasbourg Cathedral, has a picture of Mary with stars around her head and an octagonal crown, which the octagonal crown represents the German power with Europe in submission. We have those 12 stars that I mentioned. The 12 stars actually form, these 12 gold stars on a blue background is the flag of the EU. And it was said that they were inspired by Our Lady in Strasbourg. And despite the fact that some thought that it was 12, because until the 1990s there were only 12 states, people thought that it was 12 because there were 12 states. So when they expanded to 80 or 15 or 18, whatever, that there would be 18 stars. Not so. They were constant because they were drawn from Revelation 12, which is interesting. Very Catholic. When Tony Blair signed the Constitution of Europe in 2004, where did he go? He went to Rome and signed it in the Forum of Julius Caesar under the very watchful eye of a statue of Pope Innocent III. He's very significant. They could sign it anyway. There are some beautiful hotels in Europe, and they could easily rent these wonderful conference centres, but no, they choose places of Catholic worship. The Lisbon Treaty, yes, it was signed in Lisbon. Where in Lisbon? In the Geronimo's Monastery. Okay, it's Catholic, but ask the question, is it really interested in a subdued British nation? Yes, it is. Even the Queen, when she visited the Pope, symbolically submitted to the Pope. How did she submit? Because she agreed to wear black when she appeared in his presence. That can only be taken as submission. What she thought, I really don't know, and no doubt, to be fair, it was probably a political move rather than her completely admitting submission to the Pope. But still, the event was significant. And, as we've said, under the Lisbon Treaty, all British subjects are now EU subjects. There are no exceptions. The Queen is included in that. 2009, my friends, marked the end of a 476-year period of British independence from Roman Catholic Europe. Going back quite a way now, bearing in mind that Britain has been in the European Union for several decades now, 1993, the first sacrament of penance since the Reformation. So we're talking 400 years. The first sacrament of penance was held at the Palace of Westminster. This is something that, despite all its faults, the Church of England has never engaged in. We have this old divide and rule policy of the Holy Roman Empire, because in the Holy Roman Empire, Europe was not three or four large sort of countries, or domains. It was split into thousands or hundreds of little dukedoms, principalities, etc. Why? To prevent any one ruler becoming too powerful. If you're only one of 100, it's very difficult for you to achieve anything. But if you're one of 4 or one of 5, you may be able to get enough support and enough power to actually overthrow the authority of Roman Catholicism. And look what's happening in Britain. Devolution. Wales has the Welsh Assembly. Scotland, for a little bit longer, has had even more of an independent status. And even places like Yorkshire and Cornwall are beginning to get their own sort of little government things. They're by no means independent, but maybe we can see that this is really the direction that things are headed in as a result of the European Union policy. And not only this, most significantly, the European Union is working through the Church of England. In the Catholic Herald of December 1993, I read the words, "The days of the Anglican Church are numbered, and most of its worshippers will return to the true faith of their distant medieval forebears." Look what's going on with the Archbishop of Canterbury meeting the Pope, and the Pope saying to these worshippers in the Church of England who were upset with these women bishops and everything, "You can come back to the Mother Church." You almost feel as though the Archbishop of Canterbury is deliberately weakening the Church of England in readiness for a more united front under Roman Catholicism. So what does this all mean? What is the upshot of all these developments? The Times newspaper on the 1st of August 1996 summed it up. "If Britain loses its international independence, then the monarchy, as the symbol of our nationhood, will lose its independence as well. The crown will have lost its function, but the British people will have lost their liberty. Welcome to the Dark Ages." We're not there yet, by any stretch. We're not there yet. But that, I think we can see, is the direction we're headed in. But if we can't see that, then that's not a problem, because all that I've gone through so far is history. History isn't for fools, but it is history, and all it does is indicates man's wickedness and man's inability to rule. What we really are interested in is what the Bible has to say about all these things. What light does the Bible shed on these events? And that's what we're going to look at now, because we haven't even turned the verse from the Bible yet, and this is a Bible address. As the Pope claims, the Roman Catholic Church the Church of God on earth? That's his claim. This is the Church of God on earth. And is he really the vicar of Christ? We'd like to refer you to 4 lectures given, it'll be in about 8 or 9 months' time, on the subject of Roman Catholicism in the light of Bible teaching. And these lectures essentially show, and you don't have to listen to these lectures, you can look at any book on history and see the history of the Roman Catholic Church, and it is certainly not the kind of system, religious system, that the Bible proclaims is right. In fact, you will see that it is the very antithesis to the true church or ecclesia of God on earth. And rather than the vicar of Christ, the Pope is in fact Antichrist. But the issue here is that the nations of the world, in involving themselves in a fraternity of any kind with Roman Catholicism, will, as we will see, bring upon themselves great suffering when the judgments are unleashed on this massive religious system. And it can't be any different. If you, for example, the fall of Rover fell, but it wasn't only Rover who was affected, it was all the suppliers. Anyone who was involved with Rover was affected by Rover's fall, and it's exactly the same. When God's judgments are unleashed against Roman Catholicism, anyone who has entered into agreements, financial or otherwise, with Roman Catholicism is bound to suffer as well. And yes, the Church of England is astray from the truth, very much so. But what we're trying to say is that special reference has been made within the Bible to the Roman Catholic Church, none else. So let's quickly identify Roman Catholicism in the Bible to see what it says regarding it. Turn please with me to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And we really can't spend long, but it is worth trying to back up what we're saying by some Bible verses. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 1. We beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and by our gathering together unto him, that he be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter of promises, that the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except they come a falling away first, or apostasy, or falling away from the truth as taught in the Bible, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worship, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now if you were to throw these verses at an avid Roman Catholic, he would no doubt come up with some person in history who allegedly opposed himself and made himself above all that is called God. But Paul isn't interested in some isolated individual. He's evidently referring to an individual who would influence a great number of people. Paul wasn't going to be interested in this one-off person who sort of took 10 or 15 people with him and was never seen again. By virtue of the fact that he mentions this, he's talking about something big. And there is only one system that can fit that, and that is Roman Catholicism. Let's listen to Cardinal Manning's assertions supporting the claim of the Pope. I acknowledge no civil superior. I am the subject of no prince, and I claim more than this. I claim to be the supreme judge and director of the consciences of men, of the peasant that tills the field and the prince that sits on the throne, of the household that lives in the shade of privacy and the legislature that makes laws for kingdoms. I am the sole last supreme judge of what is right and wrong. If that's not asserting yourself above all that is called God, nothing is. He is essentially saying that regardless of what the Bible says, I am the supreme judge of what is right and wrong. It fits perfectly with what Paul was predicting. Roman Catholicism is next mentioned in Revelation chapter 12, if we can turn there, please. And we've already made mention of this because Roman Catholicism makes no bones about linking themselves with Revelation chapter 12. Revelation 12, verse 1, there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew the third part of the stars from heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And verse 9, the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Well, before we say anything about this, what we need to remember, turning to the very first chapter of this book, is that it's a book of symbol. God sent and signified it, or sign, like a road sign, you know, something which symbolizes something. That is how we need to understand the book of Revelation. So what we have here is a symbol. A symbol cannot symbolize itself. So when we read of the devil and Satan, it cannot symbolize the devil and Satan, regardless of what the devil and Satan is. And we have this sort of typical dragon, this great red dragon. It cannot symbolize a great red dragon. It symbolizes something else. And although we don't have time to look at it and look at the history, what it essentially reveals is the defeat of paganism predicted, which actually occurred in the 4th century AD. That it is still future is evident, again, from Revelation 1, verse 1, where John is told about things which must shortly come to pass. So the revelation isn't something that we are still waiting to see develop. It has been developing from the days of John. And so all these things, we cannot sort of slide them into the future. They've been happening over history, as Revelation 1 verse 1 tells us they would. But we read of this woman being in child. He is the son of perdition, this child that she brought forth. In other words, the product of perdition, or the product of a corrupting from the truth. And of course, it's from this mother giving birth to a child is where Roman Catholicism gets its identity from. And this, as we mentioned, the stained glass windows in Strasbourg Cathedral, clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. No problem. This is the symbolism of the Roman Catholic Church. And it even identifies itself as Mater Ecclesiae, Mother Church. But we have to remember that Paul predicted this very thing, that they would come a son of perdition. He says, let no man deceive you, for there must come a falling away first, before paganism is thrown out. And this is exactly what we have. If you look at the origins and the development of Christianity approaching the 4th century, we will see that there was all sorts of quarrels and all sorts of lust of money, and it became the religion of these debauched and corrupt priests. Money and establishing large churches. This wasn't the kind of Christianity that was taught by Jesus and the apostles, but it's certainly the kind of Christianity that is taught by Roman Catholicism. And if we turn to Revelation 17, we have a different symbol, but it's unquestionably the same same system. Revelation 17 in verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels, which are the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. Yes, it says Mystery Babylon, but look at the beliefs of Roman Catholicism. They can be directly carried forward from old Babylon, the old Babylon as we read in the time of Daniel. Many of the beliefs are just copies and sort of Christianized versions of those same beliefs. It literally is a latter-day or a modified version of old Babylon. And it's really not difficult just reading this, even if you're totally ignorant and approaching this, these verses, to identify it with Roman Catholicism. As we've said, Mater Ecclesiae, mother of harlots. It's the only system in the world which calls itself the Mother Church. We read in verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. How many people have died and have suffered tortures and as a result of Catholic tyranny? But verse 15 of this chapter, the waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the horn, make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be filled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city at Rome, which reigneth over the kings of the earth. But, verse 14, or verse 12, we read the ten horns, and verse 14 says, they shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Sorry, Lord of Lords and King of Kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So here we have a summary of where we can look for the end of Roman Catholicism. It's to make war with the Lamb, the Christ, but they will be overcome. So in the light of our last lecture, Britain and Europe, what then is the future for Britain? Has all the blood of British soldiers in trying to free themselves and retain freedom from Europe been shed in vain? It would appear so. And we say perhaps a time of Roman Catholic tyranny will be felt in Britain again, perhaps. But we really doubt the success of really re-establishing Roman Catholicism in Britain. We suggest that the success and we can't really predict exactly how much success it will have in re-establishing Roman Catholicism and bringing Britain further and further and further into the pale of Europeanism. But we would suggest that it will not be entirely successful. And the reason we say that is because Britain has a very, very different future role to Europe. The finger of God has indicated a course to be pursued by Britain which cannot be evaded, and which her counsellors will not only be willing but eager to adopt when the crisis comes upon them. It is a course not only distinct from the course of Europe, but it is also opposed to the course of the European countries. And what we wish to elucidate, I have a reference to Daniel 2, and we have a reflection there of the of some of the things we have in Revelation, but with some detail as to the formation of this beast, this image, sorry. And this image, turn it in your own time, please, will be smashed by this stone power, which clearly represents Christ. And we have 10 toes, which directly and obviously equate to the 10 horns we read of here. So when we see the 10 toes, we essentially see what we are seeing here in the 10 horns. And what we wish to elucidate then is whether Britain is or isn't a part of this image, because we believe that Britain is not one of these 10 toes, and it is not one of the 10 horns, which are the same thing. Why Britain would not be part of this can be testified from history. Imperial Rome, as the name would suggest, was a simple empire. At that time, Italy, as well as France, Greece, Austria, whatever the Roman Empire was, could be called Rome. But beginning in AD 395, the barbarian tribes of northern Europe, like Germany, Poland, Denmark and such like, began to invade the empire, and eventually resulting in a short period of time when the Goths actually ruled the empire. During this time, Justinian, who was the emperor in Constantinople, was made the Bishop of Rome. And he made the Bishop of Rome the spiritual head of the empire. But what was happening was that these barbarian tribes were beginning to establish their own kingdoms. But these kingdoms were not totally independent from the Empire of Rome. They became vassal kingdoms to the city of Rome. They didn't establish kingdoms and became enemies of Rome. They became sort of vassal kingdoms of Rome, looking to the Pope as their spiritual head. And one of these barbarian kings, Charlemagne, in 799 was crowned the head of the Holy Roman Empire. So the question is then again, is Britain the symbol of the beast? Is Britain included in the symbol of the beast? And for several reasons we believe not. First of all, this beast, which if you look at Revelation again, we haven't time, this beast descends out of the sea. It can only be one sea because John stood on the Isle of Patmos. And therefore the sea we are looking at for its symbol and the area of its symbolography is the Mediterranean. Britain is in no way linked to the Mediterranean. Secondly, the British tribes were not among those who invaded the Roman Empire in the 4th and 5th centuries AD. Therefore, they cannot be one of the 10 toes or the 10 horns, because the British didn't invade Rome and set up their own kingdom as a vassal. Britain, by all means, was invaded by Roman Catholicism and set up in that sense, but not in the same format as these 10 horns or the barbarian tribes. And we can prove that Britain will be at war with the beast of Europe at the time of the end. Let's turn to Ezekiel 38, and here we'll spend a little bit of time now looking at the future role of Britain and essentially the future role of Europe too. Because in turning to this chapter, we'll have to identify various nations or peoples, which we will do and ask you to take our word for it for the time being, because we don't have time to look at the history or what the historians say about these names. But we want to see how these nations align themselves in the great day of God Almighty. And despite the course that Britain has foolishly taken with regards to the European Union, it will yet find that its allies are not those of the continent, but the old friends of the Commonwealth, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, etc. So Ezekiel 38 verse 1, And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. So we have Gog, and this is better rendered. Numerous scholars render it in a different way to what we have here, in that Gog, the chief prince of Ross, Meshech, and Tubal, rather than Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Ross is a proper name and should not have been rendered chief. It should be left as Ross. It's not a title, but a proper name. Gog. Now, it's very difficult to identify who Gog is. It's a name which means, in the Hebrew, at the top. So that's not difficult to conceive of either someone or some nation or group of people who is at the head of a great nation or power. Gog, interestingly, was an individual who came to power in the reign, in the region, sorry, of Austrasia. And Austrasia was a region, if you like, Austria, Germany, and Poland in the early 6th century AD. He came to power in a time of huge political confusion. The governors of the land didn't know what to do, and Gog seemed this obvious choice, so Gog was made the ruler. The princes in his day could not keep order, and Gog succeeded for a very short time, but came to a sticky end as he was assassinated. Keep those facts in mind, because they're interesting as we see the role of Gog at the time of the end, whoever this Gog is. Ross, however, is the oldest name known to us to identify Russia. Meshech, historian by the name of Bokart, identifies this name with the more modern names of Muscovy, or Moscow, as we know it in the West, Moscow. Tobol, there were people settling in Siberia, and the river Tobol is what gives its name to the main city of the region, Tobolsky. So we have those three names there, Rus, Meshech, and Tobol, or Meshech and Tubal, and evidently Russian references to Russia. So we have this force then, this powerful leader of the Russians, who for some reason has aggravated the creator of heaven and earth, because he says, I am against thee. So whatever Gog and these peoples have done, they've inflamed the wrath of God. But so what, we say? What has this to do with Britain and Europe? Verse 3, say, Behold, I'm against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I'll turn thee back and put hooks in thy jaws, and will bring thee forth all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armour, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gorman and all his bands, the house of Togarmah of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee. So we've got this huge conglomerate of people, some who we can identify, and some maybe rather more difficult. Persia. Well, Persia, not too difficult for those who know historical geography. That's essentially the area which we see today as Iran. Ethiopia is Ethiopia, and Libya is Libya. But what about Gomer? Historians have identified Gomer with Gaul. And Gaul, as we know, is France. And Louis the Philippe, which was the last French king in the 19th century, right up until 1848, he paid a visit to England in a vessel called the Gomer. But what about Magog? We didn't say anything about Magog, and Magog is mentioned in verse 1. This is another people that is rather difficult to identify. But some historians who looked at periods of history in times before Christ and the development afterwards have identified Magog as a son of Japheth, who migrated north from Israel, or the Middle East, and then west, and is widely regarded as the people known as the Scythians. And the Scythians occupied the regions of eastern France, Germany, Poland, and Austria. So here we have this massive confederacy presented to us. And regardless of how this confederacy comes about, because it may be just an agreement between them, or it may be an invasion or some war, who knows. But we have this confederacy. Russia, the head of Russia, leading all these Europeans together, and doing what? They're obviously up to no good. They're on a mission. Verse 8 tells us, After many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword. Again, that's not difficult to identify in the 20th and 21st centuries, Israel. And they have only just been brought back from the sword of Europe by being established as a land, as a nation in 1948. He's gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel. They have it, which have been always waste. But it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely over it. And thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. So we can only speculate as what will occur on the natural horizon to create this situation. It might be trying to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. It might be that Israel have done something to really upset Russia. It may be that the fact that Israel continue to discover natural resources in the land, whatever. God has indicated in his word that this power, this monstrous power, is to descend upon his people and the Holy Land. And as a consequence, he is against them. They can look out. But there are three sides to an argument, aren't there? There's the right side, and there's the sides of the two contenders. We have the one contender in Russia and the aggressors. We know that God is always right, so we look for a third one. And this third one is Britain and the Allies. Look at verse 13. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, Art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? Sheba is the area which we know today as Yemen, and Dedan is a province within Saudi Arabia, or historically was Dedan was one of those who migrated into sort of northwest Saudi Arabia. So you have here sort of the Arab Peninsula and the Saudi Arabian Peninsula allied with Tarshish. And Tarshish, again, we don't wish to sort of discuss too much the origins of this, but that's Britain. We had an eastern and a western Tarshish. The eastern Tarshish was India, and the western Tarshish was Britain. And they have young lions. What were those posters in World War II? The lion needs men. And they appealed to the young lions back in the Second World War. Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada. And they all rallied to help the old lion. And we have the same alliance in the days of the end. But they are unable, again we can't look in detail, but they are unable to prevent this Russian aggressor from taking the land. But just as Gog in the 6th century was murdered, just when everything seemed to be right in the land and he had established his authority, so it will happen with Russia. Russia will have established their authority. They will seem to be within an ace of world domination. They're pretty much there. They control the Middle East by now. If you look at other verses in the scripture, Tarshish will have their ships destroyed, so Britain, it doesn't even have a navy to rely on, which normally it would. Russia's pretty much all but gained world domination. But just like when Gog in Austrasia got into a position of control, he lost it very suddenly and unexpectedly. Verse 18, I shall come to pass at the same time when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord God, that my fury shall come upon my face, for in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel. Carry on reading, but verse 4 of the next chapter says, thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands and the people that is with thee. That's the end of Russia. But what about for the papacy? I really, really have to be quick here, and please bear with me for only a couple more minutes. What about the papacy? Interestingly, this marks a fulfillment in their expectations. You would imagine that, wow, you know, there was this massive army, and it was defeated by this unknown army, because it's Christ. And again, if we could turn to other passages, if we had the time, we would find that it is Christ who destroys this Russian army. It has to be superhuman. This is probably the biggest army the world has ever known. And yet it's destroyed. And you'd expect the papacy to say, okay, that's it, we hold our hands up, this is a superpower that, you know, we can't deal with. They have been looking for the Antichrist since 1590, when an individual by the name of, he was a monk, Francisco Ribera, predicted that Antichrist would come and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, and that he would be received by the Jews. Well, look out, this is exactly what has happened. This, but whoever it is, the Bible testifies that it's Jesus Christ, he's delivered the Jews from Russia, and he's proclaiming that he's going to be to rebuild Jerusalem. Not only that, that all the world has to submit to him. This is the real Antichrist as far as Catholicism is concerned. The nations of Europe will regroup under the auspices of yet another holy war. The spirit of Walter the Penniless and his crusader criminals will be revived. And under the banner of the cross, will once again march for the Middle East to attack this new superpower that has issued a decree from Catholicism. Let's turn to Revelation 17. I have another few verses, but we will sort of leave it at this one, at Revelation 17. There's some verses I was going to turn to look at the better time, but the Bible it defines to us the gospel, that it is good news for the world in one sense, depending on where we are and where our alliance is at that time. Revelation 17, verse 4, Revelation 17, verse 14, these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. Of course he will. Psalm 2 tells us, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. Roman Catholicism doesn't want any chains to be around them. The Roman Catholicism wants to issue the chains to keep others in control. They don't want to be bound. But he that sitteth in the heaven shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord hath sent unto me, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And so on. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. And Psalm 110 tells us, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. And wonderful character Simeon, who said, Lord, lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. For mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people. A light to lighten the Gentiles, and the glory of thy people Israel. That's the very last thing Roman Catholicism wants. They don't want anyone to educate the world in the knowledge of the Bible. They've learned by their own clever foresight and bitter experience that light or the knowledge of the Bible is extremely damaging to their authority and then to their coffers. They will be the very last system on earth to submit to Christ, and in fact they will not submit to Christ. Chapter 18, verse 1, after these things I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. We could have turned to Daniel chapter 2 had we had more time and seen that the characteristics of the feet of this beast, which is image which is to be smashed, was partly strong and partly broken. And that's exactly what we see in the European Union. We have all sorts of trouble. Even the Treaty of Lisbon, they had difficulty ratifying. And it doesn't just go back to the Treaty of Lisbon. It actually goes back to this European Constitution, which was an abortion. Even the French rejected it, and hence the Lisbon Treaty was born, and they modified it and probably introduced some sweeteners to countries like Ireland to get them to ratify it. All these things show that the 10 toes of this European power is partly strong and partly broken, but it will be united, and probably it will be united in some way by Russia, Gog, the land of Magog, the Russians and the Germans working together. Not only that, we have here, all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. Neil Kinnock, he was aiming to be, he was the leader of Labour and failed to win the support of the population. As a European commissioner, he earned like three or four times the amount that he would have as Prime Minister. It all revolves around money. And that's all Roman Catholicism revolves around. And you have here all the nations of the earth committing fornication with Roman Catholicism, with the European Union. Even Britain, who has traditionally been independent and a protesting country against Roman Catholicism, in these last days has made themselves ally to it. And although Britain, as we have seen in Ezekiel 38, will not be subject to the same judgments as Russia and that force, because Britain will be a supporter of the Jews, yet we have here that all the kings of the earth will suffer as a result of involving themselves with Roman Catholicism, and Britain is to be no exception to that. Jeremiah 25, if you turn there, verses 31 to 33, says tells us about the slain in that day shall be from one end of the earth unto the other end of the earth. No one is going to escape, because even aside from Roman Catholicism, Britain has rejected the Bible. It's rejected God's ways. It's pursued its own things. It's promoting all sorts of vice. We're living in the days where they call good evil and evil good. And yes, I did have quite a few verses to look at, but I'll just close now by saying from Psalm 118, it is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. Let us trust in nothing that the world is providing for us. But we do ask you to turn to God's word for a hope of a better time, and a time when all the politics of the world, regardless of what side they're on, will be brought to an end, and the law will go forth from Zion, and when Christ will rule with a rod of iron.